would wait for him to leave for work so I could check his home office.
I hid his phone under the cushion on the couch so I could sneak it into the bathroom later.
I would come up with excuses as to why I needed a particular password so I could check a certain site.
I crawled on the floor next to the bed while he slept so I could sneak his phone and take a glance at it.
I would check Google Timeline so I could verify that he was where he said he was going to be.
I read his emails and then left them unread in hopes that he wouldn't know that I had been in there.
I would take his phone when I thought he wasn't looking so I could search through it.
I took his phone into the bathroom once and it fell into the toilet. I panicked, put it in a bag of rice, explained that I had no idea where his phone was.
Help! I can't stop snooping. What do I do?
It keeps us stuck in a trauma loop. It's ineffective. Show self-respect and expect to be in a relationship with a partner that's being direct and honest, authentic and vulnerable and transparent with me. End of story, period. And I will live and act that way. I'm not chasing you down. I've got a life to live. I matter. I'm not wasting my energy and time chasing down a man boy.
On today's podcast, we have Dr. Jill Manning, and she is talking to us about snooping. She does such a fantastic job of helping us understand why we do it, when it becomes problematic, and what we can do to have healthier ways of gaining information that we need.
Mm-hmm. She's going to talk to us, friends, about the physical effects of what snooping does to us, the adrenaline rushes, the things that we're doing to our nervous system. She's going to talk about why we snoop, how it affects us, how it affects our relationships, mm-hmm. And some healthy alternatives, like Jen said. And she's going to talk to us about effective strategies to get over this and how to move forward well. There is so much clinical information. There were things, Jen and I wrote down so many quotes. This is just rich with content and also with empathy. Mm-hmm. She's such a lovely, lovely woman and so highly trained. This is an area that she's passionate to help betrayed partners with.
Yeah, not many people talk about this, especially with empathy and compassion. And with it's challenging. It'll be challenging for those of us who are recovering snoopers. Mm-hmm. And so this podcast is one to save. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So make sure you take the time to do it because it is valuable, valuable healing material.
Mm-hmm. I'm even going to suggest, listener, that you maybe pray before you dive into this podcast and listen and just ask the Lord to protect your heart, protect your mind. I'm thinking about the armor of Ephesians 6 right now. Put that on. But also, guard your heart, listen carefully and well. But I'm just going to pray that the Lord will soften your heart so that you can hear this message, because there is so much freedom in not snooping. And with that, enjoy today's podcast episode. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Betrayal Recovery Transformation Podcast. This is your place to reclaim your life after betrayal. I'm your host, Chris Rocha, here with my co-host, as always, the lovely Jen Howie. Hi, Jen.
Wow, you described me as lovely. Thank you. Thank you so
much. You're
welcome. Hello, listeners. We are so glad that you guys are here today. Chris and I are pastoral sex addiction professionals and coaching experts with over 20 years of combined experience. And we are so glad that you're here today, because on today's podcast is a fantastic guest that Chris and I have been counting down the days to interview, because we are such a fan of her content and all that she has to offer us. So Chris, tell us a little bit about our guest today.
For over two decades, Dr. Jill Manning has been a recognized thought leader, clinician, speaker, and researcher in the field of sexual betrayal, compulsive sexual behavior, and issues related to the impact of internet pornography on marriages and families she champions in this area. Her diverse career has afforded her opportunities to be published in leading research journals, to testify before the U.S. Senate. Thank you, Dr. Jill, for that. about the harms of pornography to be featured in popular podcasts, magazines, TV shows, and documentaries. And she works clinically with resilient men, women, and youth who are striving to overcome some of life's darkest challenges.
Yes, Dr. Manning is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a certified clinical partner specialist, and a certified clinical trauma professional. She's also trained in EMDR, which you guys know is one of our very, very favorite therapies. So welcome to the podcast, Dr. Jill.
Thank you. It's really a treat to be here.
We're so thrilled to have you. And wow, that's a lot of letters after your name. That's a lot. And I didn't even put them all in the intro there. So Dr. Jill, before we get into our really important conversation about snooping today, would you tell us and our listeners a little bit about how you got into this field of work and what do you like to do for fun? Just a little bit about who you are.
Sure. Thank you. So I'm Jill, and I have been a clinician for almost 25 years now. I am from Canada. I was born in Europe from Canada, and I became a U.S. citizen 2 years ago in May.
Congrats.
Wow. Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
The pandemic inspired that. And I, my passion for this topic really stemmed, I mean, even as a teen, I really had a love and passion for women's health, women's issues, social justice issues. And so in, long story short, when I finished my master's degree and started working as a therapist, I tell people this issue found me because it was within 3 months of being a brand new rookie therapist. I was shocked how regularly the issue of pornography was coming up with children as young as 5 and adults as old as 85. And so I really started taking an interest and learned to ask better questions, to get more curious, and realized this was something I wanted to study because I was really seeing the harm and the betrayal. Even though that wasn't the language that I was using at the time, I could see the pain that was being caused through secretive behaviors and deception. So I came down to the States in 2003 to begin my PhD studies. And this was my focus, was studying what the specific question I was after to answer was, what helps women who have been betrayed? What works? What doesn't work? I interviewed women both in Canada and the United States to find out what they could teach me about what they were learning and experiencing. So that is really what got me on this path.
Mm. So thankful that you were led to this path because, I mean, just even on your website, there are so many downloads, there's so much information, so much help right there for women in crisis, men in crisis too. Do you work with men as well?
I do work with men. I really value working with men. It's a smaller portion of my clientele. I believe this, I'm a female clinician, but I do work with men that have been betrayed and have had men in my groups, my therapy groups. They have a lot to teach us. I think there's a lot of stereotypes that we can get locked into. We don't have to get locked into them, but I think they do all of us harm. And when we can learn that betrayal is really a pain that humans are hurt by, whether we're male, female, young, or old.
It's a human experience.
Mm-hmm. Sadly, it is.
Yeah. Thank you. What do you like to do for fun? Aside from all the clinical stuff.
I love traveling, cooking. I walk every day. I'm really a religious walker. So that's really how I clear my mind and just connect and ground to prep for my day. I'm a girl's mom. I have 2 beautiful daughters. And so they keep me on my toes. And a lot of my fun is tied in with things that we do together with them.
Yeah. Nice.
Love it. I get it. I've got 2 girls as well. And they are. It is so fun to be a girl mom. Thank
Not
you.
Not a girl mom. I'm a boy mom.
And 2 great boys. So, all right. Well, today, friends, we are going to talk about a subject that comes up with our clients all the time, and that is snooping, otherwise known as policing, maybe even. There's some policing behaviors involved with snooping, or maybe hypervigilance as well, but snooping in particular. Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Jill, take it away. Let's start off with the question of what is snooping? Let's define that.
Sure. So snooping in really general terms, I mean, if we look at the dictionary definition, Merriam-Webster dictionary, it is to look or pry in a sneaky or meddlesome manner. And in this context with betrayal, I would say that snooping, generally speaking, and as you well stated, Chris, there's different names that we can tie to this, but it's basically going in an indirect way to get information that we believe we're entitled to or need. And we're going in a kind of backdoor fashion instead of getting it directly. And we'll talk about why we go indirect, because there's reasons why we go indirect. We're trying to obtain information that we don't feel, for a variety of reasons, we can get in other ways.
Yeah, I am a recovering snooper, and as a recovering snooper, and maybe someone who's listening to the podcast today is tempted to turn it off because I don't want to really hear about this. But when you said the word meddlesome, I was like, ouch, ouch. I wasn't meddling. I was trying to survive. Like, he wasn't giving me the truth. So I immediately, the moment I heard that word, I came up with all these reasons as to why I didn't qualify as meddling. So tell us a little bit about why people do snoop, because there is a reason, and you've got really good context as to the reasons why people do this.
Sure. Well, and I'm so glad you gave that segue, because for anyone listening, if we find ourselves going into a shame attack about this, feeling like I should, I shouldn't, all of that, I really want to give a very affirming, validating context for this, that snooping is understandable. It's a normal response and reaction when we sense or know that we're being deceived. And it's also, I look at this from the context of trauma. This is almost always a trauma response. And so I believe we can talk about this in a nuanced, clear, helpful way and affirm and validate, while also helping people, inviting people into some healthier ways of dealing with those urges when there's something we're after. So please, anyone listening, I want to be an ally and a help in this topic, and really have a lot of compassion for anyone currently or in the past, as you've said, Jen, who's gone through this. This is whatever's gone on to urge or tempt someone to go into snooping is deeply painful. We're being lied to or deceived by someone we trust the most. That is deeply destabilizing and painful. So, tons of grace, lots of compassion, no judgment for those that have done it or think they will do it. And let's talk maturely about helpful ways to get out of that trap. And we'll talk about what's a trap.
I like that you use the word urge. That to me is very non-shaming. Rather than temptation, and maybe just because of my Christian background, temptation, thou shalt not be tempted, and tempted's bad. But when you use the word urge, it is truly what that feels like. It literally comes up inside you, as an urge. So thank you for giving verbiage to that, because I think many of us who are snoopers or have been snoopers really identify
For me, it
with
felt like
that.
a compulsion. It was almost an OCD thing. I don't have OCD, but what I imagined that to be like I couldn't drop it. My brain became like a pit bull, and it would not. Okay, I love pit bulls. They're adorable. But let's say a rabid dog that would not let go of that thing, that it just, my brain wanted to do it. It wanted to go check the computer, check the phone. So compulsion is another, it was what I experienced.
Yes. Well, and Chris, I'm speaking generally, this may or may not have been the situation for yourself, but compulsion actually, or even obsession, are appropriate words. We know that approximately 30% of those that have PTSD related to betrayal trauma will have OCD-like traits. Now, those with good and an intervention, the goal is that that wouldn't be long term, but temporarily, oh, I definitely see clinically where those people start acting in ways that are not how they normally act.
Dr. Jill,
Absolutely.
as you talk about this, let me just tell you, I used to sneak out of bed, like slink off the bed. I'd get on all fours. I'd crawl around. He'd be sleeping. I'd crawl around to his side and my hand would reach up over the bed and onto the nightstand and I'd pull that phone down. I'd tuck it into my shirt. I'd crawl into the bathroom and then he'd be sleeping and I'd be up till 3 in the morning going through every app, every download, every everything. And
Exhausting.
it is absolutely exhausting. And here I am, rabbit trailing when I've asked you.
Why do
But
people snoop?
Well, they snoop because they suspect that something's awry in their gut. And we're going to talk about gut today because it's a key element of this. In our gut, we sense something's wrong in the force field. Or perhaps we have evidence something's wrong in the force field. And the force field I'm referring to is that around our key attachments. We're not as prone to have an urge to snoop when it's someone we're not close to, when we're not invested. The greater the level of attachment, the greater the threat when that relationship is someone or something's messing with that. And so it's. Yeah, we snoop because we're trying to find out what's going on. We humans by nature do not like chaos. We want things to make sense. We want this story to have a beginning, a middle, and end. When there's part of the story that's missing, we have some really interesting Jedi tricks we use as humans. We will make assumptions, we will fortune tell, we will fill in gaps that may or may not even be rooted in reality. But in order to make a story make sense, we will do things that sometimes objectively could look and sound really crazy to try to make our world stable and orderly and safe. The key word is safe. And when our attachments are threatened, we don't feel safe. So people snoop initially. My experience has been people snoop initially as a self-protective measure to try to get safety and figure out what is the scope of the threat I'm dealing with. Where are the outer limits of this? Or is it still happening? Maybe we have had confirmation, but we're wondering, is this still going on? Or that really protective sense will come up, I will not be duped again. Never again will someone pull the wool over my eyes. And so we do it in a self-protective sense. People are not snooping. Well, maybe this may be an overgeneralization. There may be some evil folk out there with really malicious intent. Okay, but that stated, the majority of people I encounter in my office, these are good-hearted, good people who are trying to make sense of an incredibly stressful and traumatic situation. And so there, it's not with maliciousness. People are they're trying to make sense of something that's really sometimes impossible to make sense of.
Oh, I love that description so much. That was great. Go ahead, Jen.
I feel incredibly validated. This is our D-Day was over 12 years ago. And even to this day, with all the healing that I've experienced, just hearing that validation goes to the very core of who I am. So thank you for explaining that and helping me understand, because a big piece of moving forward is understanding what is taking place currently.
The why.
So yeah, as soon as you can understand what's taking place currently, then you've got some leverage to move out of that and move towards something healthier.
And I can just hear women right now listening, going, well, then what am I supposed to do to get safety?
Yes,
And friend,
we're
we
going
are
to get
going
that.
to get to that. But before we get to that, there's a few more questions that we want to ask in an orderly fashion because our brain likes order, as Dr. Jill just said, right? So, Dr. Jill, what does snooping accomplish? I know for me, I was looking for security, safety, right? But I wanted all to be well with my world. And I didn't want to get hit with that Mack truck again, unawares. If the Mack truck was coming, I wanted to see it. I wanted to be in control of that as best as I could. But that's a false reality. There is no control in this when it comes to managing the addict, right? So, yeah, what does snooping accomplish for us?
In the very short term, and I'm emphasizing and highlighting that with bright yellow metaphorically here, in the very short term, it accomplishes a sense of empowerment. You know, we get a sense of empowerment. Look, there's something I can do, something I can control to get to the bottom of this. And there is often a sense of relief that is very short-lived most times, relief that we found proof, or relief that nothing was there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is not a sure foundation by any means, but very temporarily it can achieve that sense of empowerment, relief, certainty, and checking out our reality, right? We don't like it when our reality is, we're sensing something and we're trying to figure out what's going on. So that, and again, I want to emphasize, highlight yellow, bright yellow, it's short term. I'm talking, you know, once you have confirmation, once you know what's going, once you know that you're being deceived or lied to, and this is a bold statement, I realize.
Okay,
this is a bold statement, but once you have confirmation and you know that you're being lied to, my clinical position is snooping no longer serves a healthy purpose after that. We'll talk. But I see people where this goes on for weeks, months, sometimes years. And, you know, I know that we'll get into what that does to individuals, but also to the relationship and to families. So I'm not going to jump ahead there. But really, after we know that a loved one, a spouse, fiance, whoever we're in relationship with, and I'm speaking today in the context of betrayal, relational betrayal. So when we know the person we're in relationship has definitely breached our trust, is doing something in the dark that is untoward or malicious or criminal even, after that, snooping no longer serves a healthy function.
Wow. I'm not even sure what to say. I think if I was listening to the podcast right now, I'd probably hit pause and just sit on this for just a second.
It is, but I got to tell you that this really amazing person I had in my life going through betrayal once told me when I was snooping, I think you have enough information to know what you're dealing with. I think you can quit. And that wise person was Jen Howie. So thank you, Jen. But I remember her saying, I think you know what you need to know now and you can let this behavior go. It's not doing you any good. And I remember a therapist once telling me years ago in a different situation where I was snooping what it does physically to the body. I think we're going to get there too. So I won't jump ahead either, but yeah, thank you. So thank you for hitting that pause button.
Yeah,
Jen, that was, yeah.
Well, it's easier to say it to you than it was to myself, but you know, we can always point out things in other people easier than we can find them in ourselves. So how do we know when it's becoming problematic? Because for me, there was this justifiable loop that I was having, because I often refer to it as an emotional vertigo. I was flipping upside down and going all around. And I really, 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 truly justified that I had to have this information in order to survive. I believed I could not survive without knowing something. And in that moment, in that trauma brain, I did not have the wherewithal to recognize that it was becoming problematic. And I will come here and I will truly testify that snooping wholeheartedly damaged me in the short term and in the long term and in my physical body as well. And we'll get to that in a moment. But how do we know? How do we know that we have crossed the threshold into this really being problematic?
Okay. So again, this may even be controversial, but I'm sharing and speaking as truthfully and frankly as I can in a spirit of wanting to help. Because I really, my heart goes out to anyone out there listening that may be in the throes of this right now. And so we want to help. We want to help people get out of this cycle. Here's what I want to reflect back that may be controversial. And I will say, I am not making a false equivalency between someone who's betrayed with the betrayer and their behavior. However, what you just described, Jen, if we were just reading what you said, we didn't know your gender, age, that you had been a betrayed partner, there are so many similarities to what you just described in your process and someone who's compulsive or in an addiction.
Yes, absolutely.
I had a need. I couldn't even tell that it was problematic for me. I was in so deep. It was justified. I knew why I was doing it, and I did it.
Oh, yes.
Doesn't that sound similar to someone that is out of control, whether it's gambling, eating, sex, porn, whatever it may be?
Yes.
And so here's the kicker. We can't tell clearly that it's becoming a problem for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's like asking an alcoholic, when was the day you knew you were an alcoholic?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay. And often they'll give, if you listen to podcasts with recovering addicts, they'll describe a gory rock bottom often. Okay. That's not when they became an alcoholic. Okay. Yeah. It was often long before that. So we need safe, good people around us to reflect it back. Like you said, Chris, it took Jen saying, whoa, stop, no enough. After that, it's not helpful because we don't see clearly. Now, why? Because when we're in a traumatized state, our frontal cortex goes offline.
Yeah.
We are using base brain, middle brain, emotional centers of the brain to survive. Mm-hmm. These are survival instincts. So there's no shame in that. And everyone, myself absolutely included, we are all vulnerable to trauma, and having that lower brain take over in the driver's seat. In that state, we lose perspective, we lose nuance, we become rigid, black and white, we become very prone to urges and getting out of control of things. Our frontal cortex is not in the driver's seat saying, you know, there may be other ways to deal with this.
Yeah.
That's not what's happening. So I want to, again, not a false equivalency between how out of control and destructive full-blown addiction and compulsive behaviors can be, but there are some key similarities in that we lose perspective and it is problematic, and we don't have good clarity of when it is becoming problematic.
Thank you for speaking to that. I didn't know it was problematic until I was having physical symptoms that I was able to recognize when I was back in my window of tolerance. When you're out of your window of tolerance, you don't have access to any of that prefrontal cortex at all. So you can't really talk even yourself out of those things and often justify it. But as you're sitting here talking about this, I just had this very personal moment of empathy for my husband, because I really, wow, my adrenaline was rushing. I make an excuse because I have to get out of this pain, and I'm going to use this to get out of pain, and I will use it, and it's going to work. But like you said, it's only temporary. And then it comes back probably even before the end of the day, before I'm in this cycle. And now my whole life is revolved around this behavior.
Oh my gosh.
This compulsive
yeah.
behavior. And I don't think for one minute, Jill, that I even considered that I could empathize with my husband. And I'm not asking women that who are listening right now to empathize with your husband. I am just testifying right now. This is a moment that I'm having where I'm like, I'll never be able to understand what you did. I'll never be able to relate to that at all. And now just in this moment, I'm like, holy smokes. I actually think I do. I recognize my need to run away from the pain and to somehow anesthetize it with, in this case, information, and how I was on that loop. And I low-key love and hate this.
That was a great aha moment for you right there.
For sure.
Well, and what you're describing, Jen, I think is a reflection of good healing work you've done. And we're just meeting for the first time today. But that statement, what you just shared, tells me that your brain is grounded and healed enough that your empathy can come on board. When we're in high shame and high trauma, those two things can't coexist, because the same part of the brain that's needed for learning, for empathy, for relational bonding and attachment are the same parts of the brain that go offline when we're in fight or flight. I think it's a statement and testament, without me knowing your history,
beautiful,
that you've done healing work. That I can start coming on board. So, I mean, let's get into what this does, because I think we need to talk about the effects so people can have the education to really understand why we're urging and inviting people to take a second look at this
Let's do it. I do want to say real quick that as you were taught, as you were both talking, I was thinking about my experience and thinking there was ritual involved. And so just like the addict, oh, she's going to leave at this time, or this opportunity is going to, you know, come. I did that. He's going to be gone here. I can grab this device. I can check this thing. I can get onto, you know, the website. You know, I can check all the things. And there was ritual involved for me. And there was a high that went with that. The adrenaline rush happens. There's some planning and some thinking. And I remember Jen saying to our group, because she was my group leader too, that there can be some addictive behaviors there, and there's an addictive reward in that as well. And then a therapist a long time ago, like I said earlier, had said, don't be doing this to yourself, because the adrenaline rush that you're experiencing when you're going to go hunting, when you're going to go policing or snooping, it's washing your internal organs in an amount of adrenaline that is only meant to get you running from a bear. If there's a murderer in your house kind of thing, and you are on the daily putting your nervous system in that flight danger response. And she said, and I don't know if there's science behind this. I think there is. It makes sense to me. This is how we get cancer. This is how we get Parkinson's. This is how we have heart attacks. This is how we break our body down. So it's not good for us, even physically, let alone emotionally or spiritually. So yeah, Dr. Jill, what is the impact of prolonged snooping? What does that do to us as humans?
Well, wait, the story you just shared is a perfect segue to this, because what it does is it keeps our whole system in a high stressed state. It keeps us stuck in a trauma loop. Mm-hmm. And you're correct. 80% of diseases are stress related.
Wow.
And we also know that when a human is highly triggered, has a big stress response, which of course trauma is. Trauma, you know, that's a prolonged stress response. We know that it takes 3 to 4 days for the human body to metabolize that dump of cortisol, adrenaline, all the neurochemicals that get surged in the body for survival. So if someone is snooping, let's say twice a week, they are in a near constant state of being overloaded with a cocktail of neurochemicals that keep them in a stress response, even on the days they're not snooping.
Wow, I did not know that.
Depending on the frequency with which they're doing this. So it is incredibly hard on the body. It is incredibly hard spiritually. You can't be connected to your spiritual center and grounding when you are in that state of survival. You can't have peace of mind and that stillness that's needed to connect to your core values and truths. So this keeps people very dissociated from what matters deeply to them. Mm-hmm. And it keeps them in a very distorted state. I also, my experience as a clinician has been that, I mean, keeping people stuck in a trauma response, that alone, period, end stop, that's enough to motivate me to want people to help people get out of that. But it also will heighten mistrust. Mm. It will keep people in a loop of mistrust of themselves.
Oh,
as well as others. Why ourselves? Well, if I'm sensing things are going well, and then I find evidence of something, then I start mistrusting, am I reading reality right?
Oh,
I had no idea this was going on. What's wrong with me?
I'm a fool.
So yes. we get disconnected from our gut, and we have more of a spirit and lens of mistrust of our partner. Now, I want to say that mistrust of our partner may be completely justified. That may be an accurate reading of reality, which is even more reason why we need to be as grounded and in our frontal cortex as possible so that we can respond effectively. So it's really about recognizing we're in this, regulating and responding. Our power, true empowerment, as Pia Melody says, is living in action rather than reaction. When we are snooping, we are living in reaction. We are on a reaction loop over. That is not a response that's going to get us anywhere productive.
It's interesting that you say that, because in my brain, I believed that I was being empowered and that I was living in action, not reaction. But I think you bring up, this is something that I really want to highlight that you just brought up. If you're not connecting, if you're not able to connect to your spiritual self, if you're not able to have moments of rest, if you're not able to have moments of calm, these are not your words, these are mine, but so go ahead and just jump in here. But you had just said it a moment ago, these are signs that this is problematic and that this is actually hurting you and not equipping you to heal. And I don't, now that you say that, I check all these little boxes off of my head. So if you're listening and you're struggling with urges to snoop for valid reasons, if you're not able to connect to these moments of downtime, of rest, of even moments of safety, then it's and you are snooping, it's a pretty good signal that you need to press in, reach out to a therapist, and address the issues that are at hand and specific to this area, because that's a great list of symptoms that it's problematic.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a bigger picture kind of way, clinically, I believe the goal of why we're on this planet is to grow, right? This is, I see life through a lens of progression. We're here to grow and learn and develop and mature. Mm-hmm. And I know the two of you are people of faith. That's also mm-hmm. scripturally grounded, mm-hmm. right? When Paul in Corinthians is talking about, you know, when I was a child, I spake as a child, you know, I lived as a mm-hmm. child, misquoting this, I apologize. You know,
you're good.
But then as we're adults, we are expected spiritually to come into a mature place. Snooping and behaviors like it will keep us in an immature, ineffective posture of communicating and relating. There's, that's just what this is. It will keep us in an immature and ineffective way of relating and communicating. Mm-hmm. So it's going to keep us stuck, and it's going to keep us in what I would label as a clinician, an adapted child role. A lot of people, if we ripped up birth certificates and driver's licenses, mm-hmm. and we looked at people's emotional age,
then I'll be under the age of 10.
Okay, this is a very young behavior. Now, we can say that with compassion. That's not a shaming statement. When any of us are traumatized, we will emotionally regress to sometimes very young ego states. Mm-hmm. So I want to put a plug in here too, that ongoing snooping will keep people stuck in immaturity, and that to get out of this and to really do the work of healing will help us mature and I think grow spiritually as well, and really take action that gets us somewhere where it's, I mean, that's what I really want for people is growth and healing, peace, respect, honesty, all those mm-hmm. good things that I think each of us have a right to, but to help us really become more functional, mature adults. Mm-hmm. It gives us a false sense of control. And so are we going to be in reality and really seeking true power?
Yeah.
And all that that means.
And real security.
Real security or living in illusion. Mm-hmm. Because when someone snoops, I've heard countless stories of snooping. And I've done more disclosure work. I couldn't count how many disclosures I've heard. And it is really fascinating when you sit in a room where a disclosure that's been polygraphed is being shared, and you have a partner who previously was in neck deep into snooping, and they realize, wow, their snooping wasn't even getting to what was actually going on.
Yeah.
And even when they were finding stuff, it wasn't the full picture. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember a story that, and I hope this won't be too triggering, of someone. She was like the pro snooper. The FBI needed to hire this woman. I think the SEAL teams, the FBI, like they could have a whole demographic of betrayed partners.
Was her name Jen Howie?
Killer SEAL team on their hands. And so this was a pro snooper, and she felt very justified in it. I'm going to get back to justification in a minute. And I'll never forget in her disclosure, her husband talking about his pervasive use of burner phones. And it was so bad, he was hiding burner phones in the tiles of the bathroom ceilings of hotels he would stay at on his business trips. And he would just make sure he stayed in the same room. He'd request the same room. None of her snooping was going to get to that. So
no.
I really want to put this like billboard message into our podcast. It's ineffective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I thought this really could work, go for it. But it doesn't work. And I've seen evidences of that again and again. And even when you do find something legitimate, like proof of something, when the addict or the betrayer or the unfaithful finds out that you have proof, what happens if they're not in good recovery?
They gaslight, they minimize, they deflect.
It goes underground, they get better, they go higher, deeper, sideways. It is an ineffective cycle for both people.
Yes.
So I want to talk briefly about victim offending and justification. Victim offending is when someone has been victimized by another person's choices, but that person gets into this mentality of, I have a right to snoop. I'm entitled to, she does have a right to information, but that sense of entitlement, I have a right to get to the bottom of this and I'm going to do it. Come hell or high water, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. And it really gets into this victim offending role where then she's justifying sometimes even illegal behavior to get into. I mean, I've seen and heard of women breaking into work computers, getting passwords in even illegal ways to get to stuff. And there's a justification and rationalization with that that gets very scary. It's a very slippery slope. And so I want, again, validate the pain and the drive that goes into this, but I really want to clearly communicate there are healthier, better ways of getting to the information that people are entitled to. When we are married and we share reality with someone, we are entitled to know what someone is doing in areas of life that can directly harm us. I believe wholeheartedly.
Yeah, I would like to add to that in that I never really stopped and took a look at what I was contributing to my own trauma.
Yes.
I was one of those women who hacked her husband's computer. And I saw in real time conversations he was having with other women while I was at work. I wasn't even doing my own job. And I was damaging myself, and I didn't realize how I was contributing. Rather than teaching myself, my gut is trustworthy. I don't have to see with my eyes. My gut knows, my body knows. And I just bypassed that and said, no, gut, you don't know. Your eyes need to see. And as I was doing that, I was contributing to my own health, my own setbacks, my own trauma. I was creating my own trauma by feeling entitled to this information. When if I had had the capacity just to get within my body, I knew what I needed to know. And I did not realize I was causing myself damage, and I blamed him. Well, if he hadn't, then I wouldn't
then
have
I
to
wouldn't.
Do this.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I wouldn't be damaging my body if he would just tell me the truth. When in reality, the damage I was doing was the cycle that I was on and not getting into some of the instinctual things that I actually had access to within myself that I didn't. Because like you said, you can, where there's a will, there's a way.
Mm-hmm.
So
I remember you, Jen, saying to our group that this was a form of pain shopping. And Dr. Jill, I'm curious, pain shopping is a term that you use. So it's a little bit like emotional cutting is what I share with my clients, that there's that adrenaline rush. Maybe there's so much pain and trauma in what you're experiencing that when you snoop, there's a little bit of pain shopping. There's this false sense of control, and it feels like it's painful, but it's a different kind of pain. Like we falsely think we're in charge of this. We've got control of this. We can hit the stop button. But I'm just wowed by what you shared about that it takes 4 days for the human body to process the cortisol and adrenaline and all of that. And so even when we're feeling a little bit chill, where we're not behaving or engaging in those behaviors, we're still hurting ourselves. Also, when I'm talking with clients, And I'm putting myself on the chopping block here, because you might go, that's not quite right. But when I'm talking with my clients and I'm trying to explain prefrontal cortex versus the amygdala or the limbic system, which is our fight, flight, freeze, go numb, it's our safety brain, I tell them to try to remember their earliest childhood trauma. And it might be something like something horrible happened to them, or it might be that they lost their mom in the grocery store and they thought that they got left behind. So it could have been something small. It could have been something honestly awful, or anything in between. But the first time that we as children go into that trauma situation, that fight, flight, freeze, the limbic brain, I tell them, remember that situation. Don't tell me what happened, but now tell me about what triggered you now. Explain what were you thinking? What were you feeling? What were you believing? And now does that relate to when you were 6 years old and you got left in the grocery store? And they're like, oh my gosh, yes. So we are literally reverting to my earliest childhood trauma memory was when I was four. And so when I'm in trauma now in my 50s, I'm reverting to a four-year-old brain. That's layman terms. I am not a therapist and I don't play one on TV, but would you say that's kind of accurate, just to help our listeners understand in layman terms a little bit what you were talking about earlier?
Yes. When we get stressed, tired, when too much, too little of anything takes us out of that window of tolerance, we will revert. We will regress. Regress means we go back to an earlier state, and we often go back to what worked. You know, whatever coping mechanism our brain learned, haha, this worked.
Yes.
We will go back to what's familiar and what I'm putting worked in quotation marks. And something may have worked back in the day when we were little, but it's now not fitting into an adult complex situation that we're dealing with today.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's just so essential to get the support we need to move into more healthy, functional ways of dealing with this. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're going to stay stuck in very immature states. So let's start actually with what healthy relationships involve. And we're just going to, this is not a comprehensive list by any means, but in a healthy relationship, an adult couple is able to be honest, vulnerable, transparent with one another, there is respect, and they are able to turn toward one another in moments of stress. And so and both are understanding that there's boundaries needed to protect that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's yeah. In a healthy relationship where we turn toward one another. And that's really how human attachment works. We in our culture, where with romantic love, we don't have arranged marriages, but as a mother of daughter, I'm rethinking that. That may be
Amen, sister.
Jokes aside, okay, we operate on a system of romantic love in our culture, and we choose our person. We operate on a buddy system of sorts, and that buddy, that person, our partner, is the person we make covenants, promises, vows to. Hey, we are going to do life together. We are going to be able to go out into the world, but we're going to come back to one another, debrief, support each other, love each other, and we're going to have each other's backs. What is so insidious and destructive about unfaithful behavior is it torpedoes that system of attachment and safety, where someone's going outside that circle of the relationship to get some sort of a need met, to cope, to regulate in some way. And whatever it is they're using, they're turning outside the relationship to do that. And that's harmful. That's very jeopardizing and threatening to that buddy system and attachment. And it evokes trauma. In fact, so much so that we know betrayal trauma is more associated with physical illness, depression, and dissociation than other fear-based traumas. It's wow. Very serious. When people minimize betrayal trauma as, oh, that's too bad, her feelings got hurt, or, you know, a lot of people cheat, what's the big deal?
Yeah, it's not like you went to war.
Right? Right? And actually, I grew up in the military, and on that point, I have family members, and I've known many people with PTSD related to service. I am in no way minimizing combat trauma. Mm-hmm. The soldiers are trained for that. They're prepared for that. They're uniformed and armed up for that.
Great point.
They're flown home and they are met with yellow ribbons and parades often. And what they see and do can be horrific. And so again, this is not minimizing combat trauma, but there is nothing that prepares us for living with the enemy.
Yes. Thank you.
Wow. Wow. There's a mic drop.
That's a different kind of trauma.
That's crazy powerful.
I'm not armored up for that. I don't get training. Oh no. Hey, you find out he's cheating. This is what you do. Mm-hmm. There is no training for that. So this is deeply, it's not just trauma. It's primal distress. This is our whole system, spirit, mind, heart, all of it. It is a deeply distressing experience when someone goes outside the relationship in a secretive or deceptive way to get whatever it is met they think they need to meet. It's also what I call hyper-autonomous. Hyper-autonomous. Autonomy, self-reliance is a good thing, but it can become so much so that we undermine faith in a God, we undermine faith in a relationship, trust, and we're basically saying, I'm my own God. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to rely on myself to figure out how to regulate, deal with my pain. That's what often addiction is. It's a way to regulate pain. But guess what? That description also fits what we're talking about with snooping. It's a hyper-autonomous act. It's saying, I'm in charge. I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I'm going to count on myself to get the data I need to figure out what's going on. So again, I'm not making a false equivalency, but what I am saying is when either party in a relationship are turning outside of the relationship to get information or needs met, we have a big problem on our hands.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening with snooping. She's going, and I'm speaking in a gender segregated way because all three of us are women.
Yes.
I'm all aware unfaithful behavior can go in either direction.
Yes.
But when she's going, instead of turning to him and saying, what's going on? I'm sensing something. Something's not right. Tell me the truth.
Mm-hmm.
When she doesn't have trust in that system anymore, and she's going outside the relationship and he's saying, she's no longer my safe person. She's freaking out on me. She's criticizing me. She won't have sex with me. She's mad all the time. She's no longer my safe person. I feel justified in going outside the relationship to get attention, validation, or a dopamine hit. We've got a major systemic problem going on now. I can almost hear listeners saying, because it's a universal scream, but I can't see what he says.
Yes, yes.
What's the point of asking him if he's just going to blow smoke or gaslight me anyway? Great point. So this is where we have a whole system in distress, and guaranteed every child in that system is deeply, deeply impacted when one or both parents are going outside of the marital or relational bond to try to get information or needs met.
Mm-hmm.
That is a distressing system energetically. Even if we think children don't know what's going on, that is energetically a distressing system to be in. And research shows the bulk of children know more than what we think they do.
Yes, mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
So this is where this gets into high level healing work. It starts with gut work. It's education, realizing, giving people the tools and information to know what's going on, to like make sense of the madness, that this is a trauma response. This is what it's doing. This is why it's harmful. Mm-hmm. We validate, we support, and we compassionately and gently invite people to get out of that trap because it's doing harm to them and it's doing harm relationally. And so what do we do? I mean, I think that's the $1 million question, right? What are more effective strategies to deal with this?
Yes. Tell us, please.
So for, you know, assuming someone's got the education and supports in place and they're starting to understand what this is, why they're doing it, self-care. And people may groan like, oh, everybody says self-care. We've got to help this person's system get grounded and nurtured so that their frontal cortex can come back online, mm-hmm. that they can think more creatively and pull on their good problem solving.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just this last week, I had a doctor's appointment. I work closely with a functional medicine doctor. And I said to her, Dr. Martinez, what's the number one thing that I could do for my health right now? You know, given my age and all my vitals and labs and everything. And she said, gut work. You need to work on your gut.
Yep. 100%.
Okay. For inflammation, for all gut work. And I thought, that's so true for psychologically and spiritually too.
Yes. Yes.
We've got to work on our gut, get back home, knowing, hey, I do sense and I trust something's off. That's the data right there.
Believe yes. yourself. Yes.
Believe yourself. Trust it.
You didn't have to go outside, even yourself in this case, to get that information. So if you don't want a situation to be systemic, it starts right there. That is so good.
Yes. So, I mean, we've heard stories over the years. I, and this is an assumption, but I think most of us have heard stories where someone went treasure hunting to only find gold in their own backyard, or, you know, it is so true. It's there. Trust your gut. If something feels off, even if you're wrong, that's okay. Trust that. Nurture that connection to yourself. Nurture a connection to a loving God. Get centered and connect. We get so disconnected in trauma, disconnected from ourselves, from others, and from God. So when I say gut work, that's kind of a big umbrella for get back to your home base and do any form of self-care needed and grounding work to get there. And it's okay if you need help doing it. But focus on gut work.
Give us some examples, Dr. Jill, if you would, about what kinds of self-care. We've talked about breathing exercises like box breathing, which Brené Brown, you know, tells in her books that that's what they teach Navy SEALs to do when they're in a hyper-stressful situation to get their nervous system calmed down. But what I know that self-care, different sorts of self-care work for different kinds of people, but what specifically would you recommend in this situation for some examples?
So knowing that there's thousands of examples to give, some of my personal favorites are breath work and finding a form of breath work that works for you. I love bilateral music, weighted blankets, movement, you know, walking, yoga, trauma-informed yoga, anything. You know, someone may be saying out there, really, Jill, you're thinking yoga is going to help with this? This is huge. My whole life's blowing up here. What I would say is you've got to get safe, create a safety plan, and do your self-care and grounding work daily. That's the biggest thing that I see people misstep with self-care or grounding. They do it too infrequently, and they'll sit and take three or four breaths. Oh, that didn't work. Moving on. Get back to snooping. That works, right? This is a process. Your nervous system's taking a big hit. So this is daily. Treating it like, I mean, trauma is an injury. It's not an illness. So treat it as such. If I broke a leg many years ago, that was months of rehab. Every day doing stretches, nourishing my body, going slower, realizing there were limits to what I could do. Treat this like an injury and daily taking care, taking extra loving care, getting support, making sure you're safe. If what you're sensing is off or going wrong is putting you or kids in harm's way, get safe. Whatever that looks like, get
Absolutely.
Sick, right? So that's really key. And really, can I just say, there are so many good women out there that are doing way too much of his work. To stop over-functioning. When we are snooping, we're over-functioning, even though it doesn't seem like that. Okay, it seems like we're doing the biggest favor for ourselves.
100%.
No. When an addict or an unfaithful person, when they're, believe me, they get onto this pretty quickly. Because when we show them evidence, we're like, look, explain this to me. What's this sext all about? Or what's this receipt all about? Okay, they know what we're doing. The cat's out of the bag, right? And they now know they either have to go higher or deeper to get what they're after if they're not in recovery. And guess what? They also get the message, just like the kid that's lost their homework and mom's freaking out.
Yep.
Kid gets the message. Oh, mom's holding the energy about this.
Yeah. They don't have to do the work. They don't have to do the work of coming forward, of wrestling with themselves and acknowledging that this needs to be shared. And now we're also playing a cat and mouse game, which can also be an addictive loop of its own. Will I get caught?
Yeah. So if anyone out there, and I think this is most people listening, because most of our audience would be 18 and up. This is an adult audience. If you want to be married to a mature, grown woman or man, act like it. Live like that. And expect mature behavior, grown behavior. If someone's cat and mousing and not being straight and forward, we need to either figure out, what am I doing in a relationship chronically where I don't trust someone's not being direct and honest with me? That's a more fruitful question than, did he sex someone last night? Mm-hmm. Start asking ourselves the tough questions that get us in reality. Start asking the direct questions and show self-respect and expect. I expect to be in a relationship with a partner that's being direct and honest, authentic and vulnerable and transparent with me. End of story, period. And I will live and act that way. I'm not chasing you down. I've got a life to live. I matter. I have
Preach.
Value. I'm not wasting my energy and time chasing down a man boy.
Can that be our clip? Can that be our clip for the beginning of this podcast?
Oh, yes. Please. As my husband rolls his eyes, really?
Yeah.
That's so relatable.
But really, let's get into the realm of mature relationships. And if someone's not showing up, let's get into recovery. Let's ask for what we need and live that way. Mm-hmm. We do not need to crawl over glass and go in the dark to get what we are already deserving of. But we can't get into the mud with them if we really want that. We've got to rise up and live that way. Be your best self. Now, that's hard to do when we're in a traumatized state, which is why we need others. We need to be in a group or 12-step or with a therapist or coach that can help us remember, oh yeah, you've got a best self. She's there.
Yes.
We'll get back to her. But to, you know, start relying on our higher power. Start getting back to gut and saying, you know, I deserve, and I'm going to live and rise up to a relationship that's honest, transparent, respectful. And that may be that in most cases is going to be a lot of hefty boundary work of saying, I will not, or I will when this gets figured out. I think the most powerful statement to say to someone that's unfaithful is, my gut senses something off. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to leave that with you to resolve. And in the meantime, here are things I will not be willing to do or that I will be doing. And I don't know how long that will take you to sort that out, but this is what my gut and my God are telling me. And I'm going to rise up against that. So please, women out there listening, get out of the mud and work. You deserve healing. Get out of the trauma of this and start meeting your partner where they may not be at yet. And then it starts getting really clear and, dare I say, easy. And I don't say that lightly. Some of these men and women that are unfaithful, they're making it easy for us and we're making it hard. We're the ones prolonging this. We're the ones prolonging this because we're doing their work and we're chasing after them.
Oh my God.
Stand strong in your integrity and expect what you expect and deserve.
Amen. And
make it easy. If they're not showing up in recovery, if they chronically are not showing up in an honest space, they're making that really easy for you.
Yeah.
Don't make it harder.
Yeah.
So
good. I don't even have words for pursue your own healing. Pursue your own healing. This is why we tell women, pursue your own healing. Don't worry about what he is or isn't doing. Pursue your own healing. And I've said this ad nauseum on this podcast, that one of the best things I did to recover from betrayal trauma was to invest time and energy and resources into being able to articulate my identity. Once I was able to recognize my strengths, my gifts, my purpose, my God-given identity, and knowing that he put me here for this time for a reason, and I need to get back to it, that gave me so much confidence to take up my space and to move forward with confidence. It's a game changer for sure. So
I love that you said, I'm going to rise up.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then you just have those like three little dots right after that, because for any of us today, what area of my life do I need to rise up? And I immediately, as I asked the Holy Spirit to speak to me, three things are coming to mind. Mm-hmm. There are certain specific areas in our life and in our relationships where we can rise up. And that is where the empowerment is. Mm-hmm. So it may not be leave him today. It might be write a safety action plan or draw a boundary. So it can be in very small steps, but I love that. I'm going to rise up.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Jen, again, I want to reflect back. What you're saying reflects some really strong healing work of your own in that perspective, because guess what? When you ask a question and when we're getting curious, that is so much healthier than snooping.
Yes.
And going down. Getting curious is what helps us rise up. Getting curious about ourselves, our situation, our reality. That's a different path, right? That helps move us forward.
That's good.
And, you know, and one other, I forgot to mention polygraph. I know some people are very against that. I've seen appropriate, healthy uses of it in disclosure and in certain points and in recovery. It can be misused. It can be overused, of course. I never want polygraph to override gut work. Gut work has to lead out, and good testing simply affirms and confirms what our gut's already telling us. But that is also a resource. If someone listening has not heard of that before, there are fidelity tests and ways to incorporate polygraph testing into a larger treatment plan that can be a really effective resource. So I wanted to mention that. Your listeners are going to get a copy linked to a handout that I did on snooping. At the back of that handout are diagrams. They're not the best. I'm not a graphic designer.
Are you sure? Because it's a pretty beautiful handout.
Well, thank you. But I hope it's helpful for people. And I want to bring attention to those three diagrams. Take a peek at those, because the third diagram, one shows a healthy relationship in diagram form. You know, people are turning toward one another and they're protected with healthy boundaries. In an unhealthy relationship, both people are turning outside. In a healing relationship, let's say someone, the unfaithful party's not in recovery, they're still acting out or in full-blown addiction, let's say. The partner can still turn toward with expectation of honesty, but have really good boundaries around herself while she's doing that. And taking in the data of what he says or doesn't say. Another great tool is check-ins. Do a regular check-in, recovery-focused check-in. Now, if someone says, oh, we've tried that, I don't believe what he says, you're missing out on a great data gathering situation. You don't need to snoop. If things are in place like a check-in, you're getting data every week or twice or however often you're doing that. If someone's not congruent, or they're just shallow surface, you will sense that. So it's now in the open. This is direct. I'm not having to snoop. I'm expecting direct information and data coming between my partner and I. And I can use that data over time to decide, is this relationship moving in a direction that helps both of us become our best selves, or is this staying stuck? But snooping will keep, it'll be a factor that keeps individuals and relationships stuck.
And make it worse sometimes. Yeah. My head hurts from nodding so much. I need a massage. so much good information. Thank you.
Well, Dr. Jill, do you have any final words of encouragement that you would like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, we've covered a lot, and
I thank you
so much for the forum that you're creating through this podcast. But I think it's just an invitation for people to heal, to know that they can heal.
Yes.
It's deserving of healing.
And yes.
If you're stuck and unsure where to start with that, you know, I know your podcast and resources are there, and you know, there's
dozens of websites and places that can give you a lot of free content even. Mm-hmm. So just start somewhere.
That's good.
Start somewhere and keep going, because healing is possible and it's available.
Mm-hmm. We will have that free handout in the show notes. Also, coaching with Jen and I available. Our websites will be in the show notes. Dr. Jill, how could listeners reach out to you if they'd like to? How can they get a hold of you?
Sure. They can go to my website, drjillmanning.com. I've got lots of resources and links there.
Yes, you do.
And I only work individually with people that are within my state of residency and license, which is Colorado, but I do offer 1 and 2 day intensives. So people fly on the second Friday and Saturday of every month. If people are really wanting to work with me, I keep those reserved and separate from my individual clinical work. So that is one way.
That's excellent. That's fantastic.
Wonderful.
Thank you. So like I said, these resources will be available in the show notes. Dr. Jill, thank you so much for taking us up on this invitation. You are so busy and you're doing such big work, and you've been at this for such a long time and you didn't even know us. So I totally take this as a divine appointment. We're so grateful for your time and to get to know you a bit. And I just love how things work in God's economy. He is such a good provider. I've learned so much today. I know Jill has too, Jen has too, because it was very cohesive. Her head was nodding as much as mine was. And I just, my brain's exploding. So this will definitely be a podcast that I listen to again. We have been, Jen, so blessed with amazing guests on this podcast. God has provided so well, and we're grateful. And Dr. Jill, in the future, we'd love to have you back. So
great.
You have carte blanche, whatever you would want like to talk about, you've got the floor. So
wonderful. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Absolutely. It's been a delight and very educational. So on that note, everyone, thank you for tuning in and being a part of our podcast community. As always, your support is valuable and we're here to serve you. So remember that healing is a journey, not a destination. And as we navigate the path of recovery and transformation together, today is a great example of that. Just know that you're never alone. We're here with you. So stay strong and stay hopeful and keep working towards your brighter, empowered future. And until next time, we wish you all well, take good care, and embrace your healing journey. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Betrayal Recovery Transformation Podcast with your hosts, Chris Rocha and Jen Howie. We hope you've been helped and encouraged. If you value the content we shared today, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review. This helps others find the show. Need personalized guidance? Please contact Chris or Jen for transformative coaching. This episode has been brought to you by HealingWithTheHowies.com, WatermarkCoach.com, and with the support of Pure Life Alliance Ministries.